hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down to be. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. If you want to find a collection of over 300 really great YouTubes, videos on a variety of nationalist topics, particularly a lot of information on revisionism, speeches and interviews with Ernst Zundel, David Irving, Robert Faurisson, and many others. Here is a BitChute connection that you may want to check out. So BitChute, and all one long word, John Robinson 101. So capital J O H N, capital R O B I N S O N 101. Now I'm going to play something from that. This is Let's Be Proud, Stand Tall, European Men and Women, No More Apologies. And this is called No More Apologies. And I think there's a really strong message here.
We often hear that we must pay for alleged wrongdoings of our imperial past by submitting to massive immigration into our homelands. This argument depends upon white guilt. Some of our people get a rush from indulging in ethnomasochism. But we can smash this politically correct charade simply by refusing to apologize for who we are. I'm not sorry for the colonization of indigenous peoples. After Europeans left, they went back to their third world ways. Moreover, these people create nothing new, except for dictatorship, cannibalism, poverty, and civil war. I'm not sorry for apartheid. After the native Africans took control, they slaughtered the whites in the area just as they did in Haiti. Have a look at what happened under Robert Mugabe. I'm not sorry for slavery. Every race on the planet has practiced slavery at one point or another. More whites were abducted and enslaved by Muslims than the number of blacks enslaved by whites. It was whites who founded the abolitionist movement and fought to end slavery. Today, various tribes in Africa continue to enslave each other. yet they say there's only blood on the hands of Europeans. If anything, under white rule, third world countries had a higher standard of living than they could ever produce on their own. After we leave you to yourselves, what we build for you is destroyed. We are not dependent on you. If anything, you need us. I'm not sorry for the Crusades. Our ancestors courageously fought to drive Islam out of Europe. If it weren't for their valor, our entire civilization would be under Islamic tyranny. That same heroic spirit still flows through the blood of our people today. Ethno-nationalism among Europeans is rising in the face of invaders. I'm not sorry for imperialism. The Mongols built the largest empire in human history, but nobody suggests that they should be denied their sense of cultural and racial identity. The issue isn't that our ancestors were imperialists, it's that we were the best at it. We came, we saw, we conquered. Such allegations against the entire white world are just excuses to rob us of our once prosperous homelands. Saudi Arabia insists that Europe should take in more refugees, when there are rich oil states capable of housing millions of them. Instead of importing their own kinsmen to their country, they offer to build mosques in Germany. I'm not sorry for the alleged Holocaust. The Soviet Khazars murdered at least 30 million of my people in Eastern Europe. We don't hear about these atrocities because Jews weren't the victims, but the culprits. I refuse to shed a tear for your Hollywood narrative. When the Jews fled Europe following the Second World War, they proceeded to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians to establish Israel. This displacement in the Middle East created resentment towards the Western world. The Zionists drive them out, and we have to take them in. Liberals will claim they're standing for human rights, but the minute you tell them whites have the right to self-determination, they scream, "You're part of the problem," thereby embracing the cultural and demographic genocide of a race that has created the very civilization they take for granted. There's no point in apologizing anyway. They merely see it as a sign of weakness and will attack you even harder. The only way to stand up for yourself and your people is to refuse to apologize. We're not sorry for what our ancestors did. We're not sorry for who we are today. No apologies, no regrets, no doubt, no compromise. We're not sorry.
That is a absolutely tremendous video, rising to the crescendo of we're simply just not sorry. This is the mental health we have to recover for our people. The recent death, apparently, and I underline apparently, by suicide of Jeffrey Epstein, the pervert, child molester, and so on, is actually very significant on a number of levels. He was very rich and very well connected. He was a Mossad agent or agent of influence. He mixed with the very rich and powerful and had considerable influence, which bought him considerable immunity for a while. This connects him with many other powerful Jews, particularly the family of his girlfriend, and apparently the woman who procured a lot of the underage girls for him, a woman named Ghislaine Maxwell. Now, she's the daughter of Robert Maxwell, who, among other things, was a Czech Jew, came to the Britain, became quite wealthy, became a publisher, was a Mossad agent, and also mysteriously disappeared at sea some years ago. This is a very good report by Whitney Webb. As billionaire pedophile and alleged sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein sits in prison, reports have continued to surface about his reported links to intelligence, his financial ties to several companies and charitable, in quotation marks, foundations, and his friendship with the rich and powerful, as well as top politicians. Earlier parts of this series, the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, Too Big to Fail, focused on the widespread nature of sexual blackmail and operations in recent American history, and their ties to the height of American political power and the U.S. intelligence community. One key aspect of Epstein's own sex trafficking and blackmail operation, but warrants examination is Epstein's ties to Israeli intelligence and his ties to the informal pro-Israel philanthropist faction known as the Mega Group. The Mega Group's role in the Epstein case has garnered some attention, as Epstein's main financial patron for decades, billionaire Leslie Wexner, was a co-founder of the group that unites several well-known businessmen with a penchant for pro-Israel and ethno-philanthropy, that is, philanthropy benefiting a single ethnic or ethno-religious group. And would you want to guess which that group was? You guessed Hindus? You're wrong. It's Jews. However, as this report will show, another uniting factor among Mega Group members is deep ties to organized crime, specifically the organized crime network, which was largely led by, at least in the past, by notorious American gangster, mobster, Meyer Lansky. Now, he was a contemporary of Al Capone. Now, Meyer Lansky, of course, was one of the very few mobsters who died neither in prison nor violently. He retired to Israel, from which he could not be extradited. By virtue of the role of many Mega Group members as major political donors in both the U.S. and Israel, several of its most notable members have close ties to the governments of both countries as well as to their intelligence communities. As this report and a subsequent report will show, the Mega Group also has close ties to two businessmen who worked for Israel's Mossad, Robert Maxwell, the father of Ghislaine, and Mark Rich, as well as to top Israeli politicians, including past and present prime ministers, who also had deep ties to Israel's intelligence community. One of those businessmen working for the Mossad, Robert Maxwell, will be discussed at length in this report. Maxwell, who was a business partner of Mega Group co-founder Charles Bronfman, a Canadian Jew, aided the successful Mossad plot to plant a trapdoor in U.S.-created software that was then sold to governments and companies around the world. That plot's success was largely due to the role of a close associate of then-President Ronald Reagan and an American politician close to Maxwell, who later aided Reagan in the cover-up of the Iran-Contra affair. Years later, Maxwell's daughter, Ghislaine Maxwell, would join Jeffrey Epstein's inner circle at the same time Epstein was bankrolling a similar software program now being marketed for critical electronic infrastructure in the U.S. and abroad. That company has deep and troubling ties, connections to Israel's military intelligence, associates of the Trump administration, and the Mega Group. Epstein appears to have ties to Israeli intelligence and has well documented, excuse me a sec here, and has well documented ties to influential Israeli politicians and the Mega Group. Yet those entities are not isolated in and of themselves, as many are also connected to the organized crime network and powerful alleged pedophiles, which have also been discussed in previous installments of this lady's writings. Perhaps the best illustration of how the connections between many of these players often meld together can be seen in Ronald Lauder of the Lauder Cosmetics Group. He's a Mega Group member, former member of the Reagan administration, longtime donor to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel's Likud party, as well as a longtime friend of Donald Trump and Roy Cohn. From cosmetics heir to political player. One often overlooked yet famous client and friend of Roy Cohn is the billionaire heir to the Estée Lauder cosmetics fortune, Ronald Lauder. Lauder is often described in the press as a leading Jewish philanthropist, and he's the president of the World Jewish Congress. Yet his media profiles tend to leave out this highly political past. In a statement given by Lauder to the New York Times, reporter Maggie Haberman in 2018, the cosmetics heir noted that he has known Trump for over 50 years, going back at least to the early 1970s. According to Trump, according to Lauder, his relationship to Trump began when Trump was a student at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, which Lauder also attended. Though the exact nature of their early friendship is unclear, it's evident that they shared many of the same connections, according to the man who would later count them both as his clients, the lawyer Roy Cohn. While much has been said of the ties between Cohn and Trump, Cohn was particularly close to Lauder's mother, Estee Lauder, born Josephine Metzer, Jewish. Estee was even counted among Cohn's most high-profile friends in his New York Times obituary. Roy Cohn was a famous and somewhat shifty Jewish lawyer who was also involved in McCarthy hearings. A small window into the Lauder-Cohn relationship surfaced briefly in a 2016 article in Politico about a 1981 dinner party held at Cohn's weekend home in Greenwich, Connecticut. The party was attended by Ronald's parents, Estee and Joe, as well as Trump and his then-wife, Ivana, who had a weekend home just 2 miles away. That party was held soon after Cohn had helped Ronald Reagan secure the presidency and had reached the height of his political influence. At the party, Cohn offered toasts to Reagan and to then-Senator for New York, Alphonse D'Amato, who would later urge Ronald Lauder to run for political office. 2 years later, in 1983, Ronald Lauder, whose only professional experience at that point was working for his parents' cosmetics company, was appointed to serve as United States Deputy Assistant Secretary for Defense for Europe and NATO. Soon after his appointment, he served on the Dinner Tribute Committee for a dinner hosted by the Jewish fraternal and strongly pro-Israel organization, B'nai B'rith. I wouldn't call them fraternal, I mean, they may be that, but they're far more. They're an outright lobby and very anti-free speech. That's the parent organization of the controversial Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, which was in Roy Cohn's honor. Well, let's see, this was a... So Lauder was then serving with the Reagan administration, served as the... on the tribute committee for a dinner in honor of Roy Cohn. Cohn's influential father, Albert Cohn, was the longtime president of B'nai B'rith's powerful New England, New York chapter, and Roy Cohn himself was a member of B'nai B'rith's banking and finance lodge. The dinner specifically sought to honor Cohn for his pro-Israel advocacy and his efforts to fortify the Israeli economy. And its honorary chairman included media mogul Rupert Murdoch from Britain, Donald Trump, and the then head of Bear Stearns, Alan Greenberg, all of whom are connected to Jeffrey Epstein. During his time as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, Lauder was also very active in Israeli politics and had already become an ally of then Israeli representative to the United Nations and future Prime Minister and present Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Lauder would go on to be one of the most important individuals in Netanyahu's rise to power, particularly during his upset victory in 1996, and he was a major financier of Israel's right-wing Likud party. In 1986, Roy Cohn died. Actually, he died of AIDS. I don't think he picked that up from a sneeze. Anyway, in 1986, the year that Roy Cohn died, Lauder left his post at the Pentagon and became the U.S. ambassador to Austria, where his tenure was shaped by his confrontation with the then Austrian president and former National Socialist soldier, Kurt Waldheim, who later became UN secretary. Lauder's interest in Austrian politics has continued well into recent elections, culminating in accusations that he sought to manipulate Austrian elections in 2012. So he was an American Jew trying to manipulate elections in a foreign country. After leaving his ambassadorship, Lauder founded the Ronald S. Lauder Foundation in 1987, and later went on to run for mayor of New York against Rudy Giuliani in 1989. Lauder was encouraged to run by then-Senator Alphonse D'Amato, who had close ties to Roy Cohn, and his longtime law partner, Tom Boland, who was D'Amato's advisor. At the aforementioned 1983 B'nai B'rith dinner honoring Cohn, D'Amato was the featured speaker. It's all one incestuous little nest, isn't it? The likely reason was that Giuliani, though once an ally of the Roy Cohn machine, was at the time deeply disliked by the late Cohn's associates, for prosecuting Cohn's former law partner, Stanley Friedman, for racketeering, conspiracy, and other charges. Giuliani also had a history of bitter disagreements with D'Amato. Lotta's primary victory, though unsuccessful, campaign, though unsuccessful, was noted for its viciousness and its cost, as it burned through more than $13 million. Don't forget, this is in the late 1980s, so that would be the equivalent of, you know, probably about $30 million today. A few years later, in the early 1990s, Lauder would join a newly formed group that has long evaded scrutiny from the media, but has recently become of interest in connection with the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, and that's the MEGA Group. Lauder, Epstein, and the mysterious Austrian passport. Before getting to the MEGA Group, it's worth noting one particular act apparently undertaken by Lauder while he was U.S. ambassador to Austria that has recently come to light in relation to the arrest in early July of Jeffrey Epstein, a finding first reported by journalist Edward Schall. When police recently discovered an Austrian passport with Epstein's picture and a fake name after raiding his Manhattan residence, the source and purpose of the passport came under media scrutiny. According to the Associated Press, Epstein's defense lawyer lawyers specifically argued that a friend gave it to Epstein in the 1980s after some Jewish Americans were informally advised to carry identification bearing a non-Jewish name when traveling internationally during a period when hijackings were more common. This claim appears to be related to concerns that followed the hijacking of the Air France 139 in 1976, when Israeli and Jewish hostages were separated from other hostages based largely on the passports in their possession. Given that Epstein was unable to meet the conventional qualifications for an Austrian passport, including long-term residency in Austria, the passport lists him as a resident of Saudi Arabia and fluency in German, which would also be a requirement for an Austrian passport. It appears that the only way to have acquired an Austrian passport was by unconventional means, meaning assistance from well-connected Austrian officials or a foreign diplomat with clout in Austria. Lauder, then ambassador to Austria for the Reagan administration, would have been well positioned to acquire such a passport, particularly for the reason cited by Epstein's attorneys, that Jewish Americans could be targeted during travel. And in light of a lot of very public concerns over threats Jews face from certain terror groups. Furthermore, the passport had been issued in 1987 when Lauder was still serving as ambassador. In addition, Lauder was well connected to Epstein's former patron, former head of Bear Stearns, Alan Greenberg, who had hired Epstein in the late 1970s, immediately after the latter was fired by the Dalton School. And Ronald Trump, another friend of Lauder and Greenberg, who began his friendship with Epstein in 1987, the same year the fake Austrian passport was issued. In 1987, Epstein had begun his relationship with his principal financier, Leslie Wexner, who is also closely associated with Lauder, though some sources claim that Epstein and Wexner first met in 1985, but that their strong business relationship was not established until 1987. Though Epstein's defense attorney declined to reveal the identity of the friend who provided him with the fake Austrian passport, Lauder was both well positioned to acquire it in Austria and also deeply connected to the MEGA Group, which was co-founded by Epstein's patron, Leslie Wexner, and to which Epstein had many connections. These connections to both the Austrian government and to Epstein's mentor make Lauder the most likely person to have acquired the document on Epstein's behalf. Furthermore, Epstein and the MEGA Group's ties to the Israeli intelligence agency Mossad also suggest Lauder was involved in procuring the passport in light of his close ties to the Israeli government and the fact that Mossad has a history of using ambassadors abroad to procure false foreign passports for its operatives. And that was actually done with the Canadian ambassador in Israel during the Mulroney era, I believe. Lauder himself has been alleged to have ties to Mossad, as he is a longtime member of IDC, Herzliya, Israeli university closely associated with Mossad. Sorry, he's a longtime funder of IDC, Herzliya. It was just closely tied to Mossad and their recruiters, as well as the Israeli military intelligence. Lauder even founded IDC Herzliya's Lauder School of Government, Diplomacy and Strategy. Furthermore, Lauder, co-founder of the Eastern European Broadcasting Network, CETV, with Mark Palmer, a former U.S. diplomat, Kissinger aide, and Reagan speechwriter. Palmer is better known for co-founding the National Endowment for Democracy, an organization often described as an accessory to U.S. intelligence, and one whose president confessed to the Washington Post that a lot of what we do today was done covertly 25 years ago by the CIA. A 2001 report reported in the Evening Standard noted that Epstein once claimed that during the 1980s he worked for the CIA, but Epstein later backed away from that assertion. The origins of the mega group mafia. The mega group, a secretive group of billionaires to which Lauder belongs, was formed in 1991 by Canadian Jew Charles Bronfman Bronfman Seagram's fortune, and Leslie Wexner, the latter of whom has received considerable media scrutiny following the July arrest of his former protege, Jeffrey Epstein. Media profiles of the group painted as, quote, a loosely organized club of 20 of the world nation's wealthiest and most influential Jewish businessmen focused on philanthropy and Jewishness, with membership dues upwards of $30,000 per year. Yet several of its most prominent members have ties to organized crime. Mega Group members founded and or closely associated with some of the most well-known pro-Israeli organizations. For instance, members Charles Bronfman and Michael Steinhardt formed Birthright Taglit, with the backing of then and current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Steinhardt, an atheist, has stated that his motivation is helping to found this group was to advance his own belief that devotion to and faith in the State of Israel could serve as a substitute for Jewish theology. Other well-known groups associated with the mega group include the World Jewish Congress, whose past president Edgar Bronfman and current president Ron Lauder are both mega group members, and they're tied with B'nai B'rith, particularly its spin-off known as the Anti-Defamation League, which is very anti-free speech. The Bronfman brothers were major donors to the ADL, with Edgar Bronfman serving as the ADL's honorary national vice chairman for several years. When Edgar Bronfman died in 2013, longtime ADL director Abe Foxman said, Edgar was for many years the chairman of our liquor industry division, chairman of our New York appeal, and one of our most significant benefactors. Our liquor industry division of the Anti-Defamation League. The mind boggles, but okay. Other mega group members who are donors and major supporters of the Anti-Defamation League include Ron Lauder, Michael Steinhardt, and the late Max Fisher. As previously mentioned, Roy Cohn's father was a longtime leader of B'nai B'rith's influential New England, New York chapter, and Cohn was later a celebrated member of its banking and finance lodge. In addition, mega group members have also been key players in the pro-Israel lobby in the United States. For instance, Mac Fisher of the mega group, founder of the National Jewish Coalition, now known as the Republican Jewish Coalition, the main pro-Israel neoconservative lobbying group, known for its support of hawkish policies, and whose current patrons Sheldon Adelson, the casino king, and Bernard Marcus are among Donald Trump's top donors. Though the mega group has officially existed only since 1991, the use of philanthropy in quotation marks to provide cover for more unscrupulous lobbying or business activities was pioneered decades earlier by Sam Bronfman, who was the founder of the Bronfman Booze Empire. He was a bootlegger in the 1930s. He was the father of the mega group members Edgar and Charles Bronfman. While other North American elites like J.D. Rockefeller had previously used philanthropic giving as a means of laundering their reputations, Bronfman's approach to philanthropy was unique because it focused on giving specifically to other members of his own ethno-religious background. Sam Bronfman was detailed earlier in this person's writing. He had long-standing deep ties to organized crime, specifically Meyer Lansky, who was the mob's banker in many ways. Yet Bronfman's private ambition, according to those close to him, was to become a respected member of high society. As a consequence, Bronfman worked hard to remove the stain that his mob associations had left on his public reputation in Canada and abroad. He accomplished this by becoming a leader in Canada's Zionist movement, and by the end of the 1930s, he was head of the Canadian Jewish Congress, and began to make himself a name for himself as a philanthropist, but for Jewish causes, of course. Yet even some of Bronfman's activities in philanthropy had hints of the mobster-like reputation he tried so hard to shake. For instance, Bronfman was actively involved in the illegal shipping of arms to Zionist paramilitaries in Palestine prior to 1948. Specifically, as a co-founder of the National Conference for Israel and Jewish Rehabilitation, that smuggled arms to the paramilitary group called the terrorist group called the Haganah. At the same time, Bronfman was abetting the illegal smuggling of weapons to the Haganah. His associates in the criminal underworld were doing the same. After World War II, close aides of David Ben-Gurion, who'd be the first prime minister of Israel, were instrumental in the founding of Mossad, and they forged close-knit relationships with gangster Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, another Jewish gangster, Mickey Cohen, another Jewish gangster, and other Jewish gangsters of the period. They used their clandestine network to establish a vast arms smuggling network between the United States and Zionist settlements in Palestine, arming both the Haganah and another terrorist group, the Irgun. At the same time that these gangsters were aiding the illegal arming of Zionist paramilitaries, they were strengthening their ties to U.S. intelligence that had first been formally, though covertly, established in World War II. After Israel was founded, Sam Bronfman worked with future Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres to negotiate the sale of Canadian armaments at half price. Oh, what a bargain! To Israel, and the bargain weapons purchased were paid for entirely by a fundraising dinner hosted by Bronfman and his wife. Many years later, Peres would go on to introduce another future Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, to Jeffrey Epstein. The rest of the Bronfman family's march on the road to respectability was undertaken by Bronfman's children, who married into aristocratic families such as the European Rothschilds and the Wall Street Jewish royalty of the Lehmans and Loebs. The Bronfman's newfound respectability did not mean that their association with the Lansky-led criminal empire had dissolved. Indeed, prominent members of the Seagram's dynasty came under fire in the 1960s and 1970s for their close association with Willie Obie Obrant, a major figure in Canadian organized crime whom Canadian professor Stephen Schneider has referred to as the Meyer Lansky of Canada. However, Edgar and Charles Bronfman were hardly the only members of the mega group with deep and long-lasting ties to the Lansky-led National Crime Syndicate. Indeed, one of the group's prominent members, hedge fund manager Michael Steinhardt, opened up about his own family ties to Lansky in his autobiography, No Bull, My Life in and Out of the Markets, where he noted that his father, Saul, or Red McGee Steinhardt, was Lansky's jewel fence of choice. Fence, you know, like crime. And a major player in New York's criminal underworld. Saul Steinhardt was also his son's first client on Wall Street and helped him jumpstart his career in finance. The ties between the mega group and the National Crime Syndicate don't stop there. Another prominent member of the mega group with ties to the same criminal network is Max Fisher, who is being described as Wexner's mentor. and is alleged to have worked with Detroit's Purple Gang during Prohibition and beyond. The Purple Gang was part of the network that smuggled Bronfman's liquor from Canada, where production of liquor was legal, into the United States during Prohibition, and one of its founders was Abe Bernstein, who was a close associate of Meyer Lansky and Moe Dayletz. Fisher was a key advisor to several U.S. presidents, beginning with Dwight D. Eisenhower and as well to Henry Kissinger, who of course was very influential in the Reagan administration and the Nixon administration too. In addition to Fisher, mega group member Ronald Lauder was connected to Roy Cohn and Tom Boland, both of whom were closely associated with the same Meyer Lansky crime network, and who regularly represented top mafia figures in court. Furthermore, another member of the mega group, director Steven Spielberg, is a well-known protege of Lou Wasserman, the mob-connected media mogul and longtime backer of Ronald Reagan's film and later political career. One surprise, and you know, when you see these connections, you can see why, whether it's Democrat or Republican, the U.S. political establishment, the two parties at the top, are virtually bought and paid for by Zionists. And so hopes of real America First policies in the Middle East are unfortunately pretty slim. One surprise connection to Cohn involves mega member group member and former president of the U.S. arms firm General Dynamics, Lester Crown, whose brother-in-law is David Shine, Cohn's confidant and alleged lover during the McCarthy hearings, another Jew, whose relationship with Cohn helped bring about the downfall of McCarthyism. Another member of the mega group worth noting is Lawrence Tisch, who owns CBS News for several years, who owned CBS News for several years and founded Lowe's Corporation. Tisch is notable for his work for the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, which is the precursor of the CIA, where Ronald Barr, who hired Epstein at the Dalton School, also served, and which forged ties with Lansky's criminal empire during World War II. Wexner's Mansions and Shapiro's Murder. Les Wexner, the mega group's co-founder, also has ties to organized crime. Wexner's ties to Jeffrey Epstein have come under scrutiny following the latter's recent arrest, as Wexner was the only publicly acknowledged client of Epstein's current curious hedge fund, the source of much of his wealth, and the previous owner of Epstein's $56 million Manhattan townhouse, which was raided by police, which Wexner transferred to an Epstein-controlled entity for free. You know, you must like ask, well, why would he do that? Before Epstein received the townhouse, Wexner appears to have used the residence for some unconventional purposes. Noted in a 1996 New York Times article on the then Wexner-owned residence, which included a bathroom reminiscent of James Bond movies, hidden beneath a stairway lined with lead to protect the shelter from attack and supplied with closed-circuit television screens and a telephone, both concealed in a cabinet beneath the sink. The Times article does not speculate as to the purpose of this equipment, though the allusion to famous fictional super spy James Bond suggests that it may have been used to snoop on guests or conduct electronic surveillance. And why would you do that, you think? The 1996 Times article also noted that Wexner bought the residence for $13.2 million in 1989. He spent millions more decorating and furnishing the home, including the addition of the electronic equipment in the James Bond bathroom, only to apparently never live in it. The Times, which interviewed Epstein for the piece, quoted him as saying that let's never spend more than 2 months there. Oh, sorry, let's never spend more than 2 months there. Epstein also told the Times, which identified Epstein as Wexner's protege and one of his financial advisors, that the house by that time already belonged to him. The same year, Epstein was commissioning artwork for Wexner's Ohio mansion. A recent article from the Times noted that in the summer of 1996, Maria Farmer, was working on an art project for Mr. Epstein in Wexner's Ohio mansion. While she was there, Mr. Epstein sexually assaulted her, according to an affidavit Ms. Farmer filed earlier this year in federal court in Manhattan. She said that she fled the room and called the police, but that Mr. Wexner's security staff refused to let her leave for 12 hours and basically kidnapped her. Farmer's account strongly suggests that given the behavior of his personal security staff at his mansion following Epstein's alleged assault on Farmer, Wexner was well aware of Epstein's predatory behavior toward young women. This is compounded by the claim made by Alan Dershowitz, a former lawyer for and friend of Epstein's, who's not been accused of raping underage girls, that Wexner had also been accused of raping underage girls exploited by Epstein on at least seven occasions. This is only part of the article. It's a bewildering, head-spinning series of sordid connections, and a lot more has got to be revealed. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Going to take my musical break right now and kind of go down the cultural path again tonight. And this is a CD of Ulster folk and Scots music that was brought to the United States, and many of the Ulster Scots settled in Appalachia. So a lot of these tunes are, you know, pretty familiar in the States.
You wonder why I sing so. Northern pride and say that line. Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland. Hi, we're a people true and proud. Sing with pride and sing and loud. Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland. I am James, a tender tale. Sing until your dying day. And you wonder why I am so proud. You wonder why I sing so loud. Cause I am James, it's home or away. To Northern Ireland all the way. For we're a people true and proud. Sing with pride and sing and loud. Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland. I will the people true and proud. Sing with pride and sing our loud. Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland.
A man to give you sweet loving as best he can. who beats his drum. For it leads to nowhere he comes from. There are men over in Paris, France, who know all about sweet romance. They know how to wine and how to dine, how to make a woman feel oh so fine. The all-American boy with his big hat, with his big wallet and his big chat, he knows how to live the real good life. You could be his fine little wife. Give me an Ulster boy who knows how to walk. Give me an Ulster boy who knows how to talk. Give me an Ulster boy who beats his drum. For at least you know where he comes from. There are men in India and Pakistan, men in China and Japan, men in Brazil and Peru. They know what to do, let me tell you. All over this world you could find a man to give you sweet loving as best he can. All over this world you could find a lad to love you through the good and the bad. Give me an Ulster boy who knows how to walk. Give me an Ulster boy who knows how to talk. Give me an Ulster boy who beats his drum. For at least you know where he comes from. At least you know where he comes from. At least you know where he comes from.
One evening for pleasure, I rambled a few fair fields all alone. Down by the banks of Lough Carron, beauty and pleasure were known. I spied a fair maid at her labors, which caused me to stay for a while. And I thought of her goddess of beauty, that blooming bright star of bright Isle. I humbled myself to her beauty, fair maiden, where do you belong? Are you from heaven descended, abiding in Cupid's fair throne? Young man, I will tell you a secret. It's true, I'm a maid that is poor. And to part from my vows and my promise is more than my heart can endure. Therefore, I'll remain at my service and go through all my hardships and toil. The lad has left me all alone on the banks of Fair Isle. Young maiden, I wish not to banter. 'Tis true I come here in disguise. I came here to fulfill my last promise and hoped to give you a surprise. All I know is you're a maid I love dearly, in my heart all the while. For me there is no other damsel than my blooming bright star of Fair Isle. For me there is no other damsel than my blooming bright star of Fair
Isle. This is Paul Crum, and you're on the fighting side of me here on White Resistance Radio. com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home.